The biggest airport in Alaska is named after a man who died in a plane crash, a man whose wife also died in a different plane crash at the airport. I'm talking about Senator Ted Stevens, who survived the 1978 crash that killed his first wife, only to die 32 years later in another crash. Stevens served in the U.S. Senate for 40 years until 2008, when, in the wake of a controversial corruption trial, he narrowly lost his seat to then-Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich. Begich's father, of course, Congressman Nick Begich, disappeared on a small plane in Alaska in 1972. So many politicians have died in plane crashes, and there are so many random coincidences tied to those crashes, too. Take the tiny town of Eveleth, Minnesota, for example. It's both where Nick Begich is from and the spot where, in 2002, U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone died in a plane crash right before the midterms. Or take Chet Morrison, the former mayor of New Orleans. Morrison, a close friend of Congressman Hale Boggs, died in a plane crash in Mexico in 1964, at the same time Boggs was serving on the Warren Commission, investigating the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Morrison actually died 6 months to the day after Kennedy. Heck, even Kennedy's son died in a plane crash in 1999. You see what I'm doing? I'm dropping a load of conspiratorial bricks into your brain. If you want, you can use them to build up some crazy narrative of intrigue and murder, or you can rely on common sense. Because people who fly often on small planes are more likely to die on small planes. There's no grand conspiracy here, no Illuminati plot cooked up in the basement of a Little Caesars. Now, that doesn't mean conspiracies never exist. They do. Plots are hatched and people are killed all the time. And let me ask you, the claims we're investigating, the claims made by Jerry Paisley, a mobster, a murderer, a bomber, that he and Peggy Begich played a role in the disappearance of Congressman Nick Begich, are they really so crazy that they didn't warrant a legitimate investigation? I don't think so. Because when you boil it down, when you remove the words mobster and congressman and bomb, what do you get? You get a claim made by a man that he played a role in the death of his second wife's first husband, and that she did too. Typically, that's the type of claim investigators and reporters take very seriously. Typically. But in this case, they didn't. The FBI never even interviewed Peggy, not once, and the Alaska news media never reported the story. It's not hyperbolic, then, in my opinion, to say that if I didn't ask hard questions, nobody would. That's why I had to go back to Alaska. There's only so much you can do from afar. I needed to be on the ground. So I was grateful to touch down on October 9th, 2019, at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport, the airport named for a man who died in a plane crash. From iHeartMedia, this is Missing in Alaska, the story of two congressmen who vanished in 1972, and my quest to figure out what happened to them. I'm your host, John Walczak. I want to talk for a minute about bodies, specifically the importance of recovering physical remains in the wake of tragedies. No matter how someone dies, when you lose a loved one, if you lack a body, you're denied some sense of finality. This is something Hale Boggs' daughter, Cokie Roberts, discussed multiple times before she died. How she knew her dad was dead, but without a body, she still imagined him just walking in the door one day. On October 8, 2019, only 24 hours before I landed in Anchorage, a man named Brian Stephen Smith was arrested at the airport for murder. But it wasn't a body that led to his arrest. It was a memory card. On the card, an SD card, which someone found on a downtown street, were photos and videos of a man strangling a woman to death and laughing while he did it. 4 days later, while in Anchorage, I awoke to another violent video. This one streamed to the world from my city, New Orleans, where a hotel under construction partially collapsed into the street, spewing up a dust cloud reminiscent of 9/11 and killing three men. Amazingly, as of this recording, 8 months later, The bodies of two of those men are still stuck in the wreckage. Both of these events, the SD card murder and the hotel collapse, are tragic. Both killed people. But in one case, a body was recovered. The remains of Kathleen Jo Henry, the SD card victim, were found on the side of a highway. In the other, two families are still waiting to bury their loved ones. Now, obviously, we all grieve differently, but most of us, when we lose a loved one, want to bury them or scatter their ashes. We want finality, that moment when dirt covers the coffin or we throw ashes into the wind. At least then we can try to move on. It's some sense of finality. This sense of finality, any finality, was cruelly denied to the families of the four men whose disappearance we're investigating. The congressman, the pilot, the political aide. Their bodies are still out there somewhere. Hale Boggs, Nick Begich, Don Johns, Russ Brown. All had wives. All had children. Begich had six kids. I am, of course, well aware that this story is making them relive their father's death and confront allegations that their mother was involved. That makes me feel kind of sick. So the idea of meeting them in person and interviewing them was not something I cherished, but I had to try. Before our trip, I told three of them, Mark, Tom, and Nick Jr., that I would be in Anchorage and asked if we could meet. The other three, their siblings, I left alone. They were young when their dad died, and I didn't want to bother them. Nick Jr. declined an interview request. Mark and Tom, however, agreed to sit down with me. But then Tom started pressing for information. Who was funding the show, etc., stuff like that. Which I get. They're a political family. Good questions. Eventually, Tom and Mark backed out of the interview, and they said their mother, Peggy, would never do an interview. Tom did, however, agree to answer questions via email, on the record. I asked about his mom and Jerry Paisley. From Tom, quote, "My mother is 81. You have deeply upset her, and it is not our intent to add to her pain. Comparing her word to that of a convicted killer is like comparing climate change deniers to the scientific evidence of climate change. These aren't journalistic equivalencies. Those are the values of entertainment journalism." End quote. Again, I understand that my investigation is painful, but I disagree with Tom. A he said, she said is not the equivalent of comparing scientific fact to denial of that fact. And I don't think Paisley's claims should be written off without an investigation just because he was a criminal, especially when evidence backs up parts of his story, his marriage to Peggy, his business dealings, his mob ties, the murders and bombings he committed, etc. I went on to ask Tom about the state of his parents' marriage around the time his dad disappeared. Now, this might seem cruel, but it's relevant. Multiple sources told me that Nick and Peggy Begich were separated in 1972, that they were on the verge of divorce. If true, that's obviously germane as we try to evaluate Paisley's claims. Tom denied it, saying, quote, "My parents had difficulty in early 1969, which they resolved that year. They were not separated. My dad was in Juneau for sessions, as was the case every spring, and even then, they worked through it together. I know that they sat all of us down and walked us through it at the time, years before the disappearance, if that helps. By the end of that year, they were strong with each other. As kids, we saw and knew that that remained the case for the rest of his life." End quote. I asked Tom about Paisley's claim that Peggy met mob boss Joe Bonanno in Tucson in 1972, before Nick disappeared. Tom said, quote, "I never considered the comment about my mom by Jerry in that transcript to be credible, not only because he was a consistent liar in my direct experience with him, not only because I know how she loved and still loves my father, but because she could not have been there as Jerry claimed. She was with us kids as our primary caretaker. Dad was often traveling or in Juneau. My mom was never in Tucson, Arizona prior to 1974. The supposed dating at the heart of his conjecture never could have happened, but that is the primary source of your conjecture. Jerry was a bartender when they met in Anchorage in December 1973, after we returned to Anchorage. When she realized how violent he was, she threw him out to protect us kids. End quote. Paisley, Tom said, quote, continues to victimize us in death as he did in the brief time we knew him. End quote. And, quote, Jerry was a violent and vicious man who had a skill at charming a person who was widowed with six kids. My father never had a will, so she gained little but heartbreak from his death. When she married Jerry, she even lost her survivor's benefit. She ended up having to cook meals and clean houses in the late 80s to make ends meet. My family is wearied by the things people like Jerry have said for their moment of fame or notoriety. We want nothing more to do with it. I wish you weren't doing this story, which will only cause hurt and accomplish little. But I understand from your words to me your reasons. End quote. Finally, Tom confirmed that Peggy was never interviewed by law enforcement in regards to Paisley's claims. After the Begiches backed out, I shifted my attention to other sources, including Tom Anderson, the former head of the Alaska State Troopers, who I interviewed in downtown Anchorage at the Alaska Law Enforcement Museum. Anderson was directly involved in the search for the missing congressmen. In 1972, when they disappeared, he was the captain in charge of the Troopers Criminal Investigation Bureau, or CIB.
This is serious business. This was the most serious search and rescue this state ever had. And there was no room for error. And the boss came down and says, hey, we will follow up on everything that comes along. Don't discount anything. And it was kind of a cover your butt thing, but it was also, you never know. So we covered everything.
I also met up with Perry Green, who's famous for two things, his poker skills, which have won him more than $1 million, and his fur shop. Green's furs are beautiful, meticulously crafted, often colorful works of art, purchased over the years by celebrities like Muhammad Ali. During my research, Green's name came up often, probably because he knew literally everyone in Anchorage in the 70s, or so it seemed, including Gene Fowler, one of two men Paisley claimed picked him up when he allegedly transported a bomb to Alaska, and Gene's brother Larry, who Paisley said they met up with that night.
Can you tell me how you knew Gene and Larry?
Well, Gene was a partner of mine until we had a parting of the ways. Larry Fowler was his brother who was just, I think he had a pawn shop at the end. Maybe he had a bar, I can't remember. But I know he was prone to drink a little bit. But Gene might have known Jerry Paisley in Arizona, I think. But just, you know, it would be hard for me to fathom that Gene would be involved any way in such a dastardly deed.
And did you know Jerry Paisley?
I knew Jerry Paisley pretty well, pretty well. He, across the street, was a Holiday Inn. Today they call it something else. And I knew him. He started there as a bartender. And he was a friendly enough sort. And he'd get off shift and he would come over here and sit in a chair. And we'd talk a little bit. And that's how I knew Jerry.
Green also knew Nick and Peggy Begich.
And what was Peggy like?
Moderately intelligent. Is that a bad way to describe somebody? She's not an intellect. She was by no means intellectual. But she wasn't from the hills either. I don't want to despair anybody who might be from Appalachia or someplace. She was an average person. You know, some people who, in spite of themselves, come from poor upbringing, but they're pretty smart people. They got a lot of moxie. She did not have what I call moxie, which is a ability to size people up or to really understand that sometimes people have ulterior motives or maybe I'm wrong.
Did you know a man named Alex Miller?
Very well. I loved Alex Miller. Everybody loved Alex Miller.
Alex Miller is the man who arranged the missing flight. Pay attention. He's important.
He was a bar owner who probably never went into his own bar, never drank, that I know of, but who always had a cigar in his mouth, who claimed friendships with big Democrats back in the East Coast. He was never a boaster. He would always get $200-$500 out of you for a candidate. I don't know whether it went to him or what. In fact, when the first governor of Alaska was elected, he had him as his chief of staff. He knew as much about how to pass legislation as I know about plumbing.
On October 15, 1972, Miller, a well-connected political operative, called pilot Don Johns at the last minute to arrange the ill-fated flight, something that always struck me as odd. See, Johns was in Fairbanks, 360 miles north of Anchorage. Why ask a pilot to fly from Fairbanks to Anchorage to Juneau when you could just call a pilot already in Anchorage? The answer lies with who paid for the flight. Nobody. It was free, likely an illegal contribution to Begich's campaign, though it's doubtful Begich knew that at the time. But why did Johns do it? Two witnesses told me he was having money issues, and Miller twisted his arm. Here's Cheryl James, who dated Johns and was the last person to see him alive.
He was having financial trouble. He had geared up for the pipeline. And then that had just been delayed, delayed, delayed. And he was paying insurance costs on all of these, I think they were called HERCs, these large aircrafts that could shuttle supplies back and forth to the North Slope. And he was behind in landing fees. And he was told by somebody out of Juneau that if he did this flight, that his landing fees, his past due landing fees, would just go away.
Which person?
It wasn't the governor, but it was somebody right in the governor's office. And I cannot remember his name.
Is it Alex Miller?
It was.
And here's Johns' friend, Tom Corometis, who was actually with Johns when Miller called on October 15th.
When he got the call and you were there, who made that call to him?
Alex Miller's, Don said it was Alex Miller.
And did Don disclose what Alex said?
Only to pick up Boggs and Begich and take him to the airport, or to Juneau. And that's when I said, and Don did say something about he thought it was bad weather, but he was going to check it out. And that's when he told me that he owed back rent on the landing fees and the rent on the hangar space.
So why am I focusing on Alex Miller? Who cares who arranged the flight? Well, if Jerry Paisley told the truth, if someone put a bomb on the missing plane, that person would have had to know the details of the flight. And the flight wasn't arranged until the last minute, on October 15th, 1972. Miller is one of very few people who knew those details. And remember, witnesses allegedly told members of law enforcement that they saw someone lurking around the plane the night before it disappeared. I'm also discussing Miller because when I started researching him, I found red flags. Most importantly, In 1976, at the height of the oil boom, he was indicted alongside a former U.S. attorney for allegedly trying to set up a large-scale prostitution and gambling operation in Alaska. He was acquitted. But again, red flags. This guy, who the mayor of Fairbanks in 1972 jokingly called the Godfather, arranged the missing flight. There's another twist, though. See, Miller worked for a man named Neil Burkt, a wealthy businessman and pilot who owned an airline. Burkt, at points, was the richest man in Alaska, a CIA contractor, and, briefly, George W. Bush's boss. But I digress. When we first spoke, Burkt told me something surprising. He claimed that he was supposed to fly the missing congressman to Juneau the day they disappeared, but he got stuck in England, he said. So he asked Miller to arrange an alternative.
If you were a Republican and the head of the Young Republicans Club, why were you arranging a flight for two Democratic congressmen?
That's my business. I didn't care who I flew for as long as I paid the bill. That's what I did.
But the flight was unpaid. It was a free flight.
You think?
I'm sorry?
You think?
It was reported in the news afterward, and I've talked to a few people.
Well, maybe I was doing it as, you know, for political reasons, and I damned if I know.
Interestingly enough, later, while discussing his company's work for the CIA, Burkt mentioned a business partner in Arizona, something that immediately piqued my interest.
These guys were out of Tucson, or this company was out of Tucson?
Not Tucson. There's an air base right out between Tucson and Phoenix. I don't recall. Anyway, that's where they're based. They were based. I don't know.
And this was a company that you worked with, or the CIA folks?
It was a company, Intermountain Aviation. But yeah, they were all CIA. No, they had several airlines. Southern Air Transport was a CIA operation. But we worked with a lot of different airlines and things around the world in those days. We had a lot of interesting operations.
Do you remember what year you first did contract work for the CIA?
Probably around 71 or 72 when I first...
You know, part of the story takes part in Arizona, so I also ask people, were you in Arizona in the 60s and 70s?
No. I mean, did I ever go to Arizona in those years? Probably. I don't know. I traveled constantly, so I probably was there.
But you don't recall going to Tucson in the late 60s or early 70s?
Yeah, I did. I went down to Intermountain one time. That was this flying business. I mean, that wasn't it. Yeah. I don't even remember what it was for. It was Hotter Than Hell.
Do you remember when that was?
No, I don't. I traveled the world for 40 years. I mean, I went everywhere.
At the end of our call, I circled back and pressed Burkt on an important detail.
I guess a question that I would have is, why call a pilot in Fairbanks to go down to Anchorage, to go down to Juneau? Why not just call a pilot in Anchorage directly? It seems kind of a long journey when there were so many pilots available in Anchorage.
Shit, I don't know. Damn if I know. I can't know. What? My recollection is it was a revenue trip, and probably it was, you know, because Don was a friend of mine, I was throwing some business his way. But you're telling me it was a non-revenue trip, so that shows you how much I remember.
It was an unpaid trip.
Yes. That strikes me as strange.
Why?
Because I didn't do much for me. You know, that was my business. And why would I fly an unpaid trip for the Democrats? I flew Wally Hickel around in a on his first campaign for governor, but I donated my time, but I made them get an airplane. And it just wasn't, giving away free flights wasn't my thing in those days. We were in the business of selling flights. But, you know, you may have better records than I do, or somebody has a better memory than I do.
In Anchorage, the person I wanted to interview most was Danny Zivinich, one of two men Jerry Paisley claimed picked him up at the airport in the summer of 1972, when Paisley allegedly transported explosives from Arizona to Alaska. After Nick Begich disappeared, Zivinich had gone into business with Paisley and Peggy Begich. The trio started Max Inc., which ran a bar, the Alaska Mining Company. Peggy was president, Paisley secretary treasurer, Zivinich, vice president. Paisley told investigators that, while drunk on a fishing trip, Zivinich said that the congressman's plane was bombed and that he played a direct role in bombing it. I did end up speaking with Zivinich several times, for hours, by phone, but he declined to do a recorded interview. Every time we spoke, he was defensive and sarcastic, though people who know him repeatedly told me he's an upstanding guy. Every time, he vehemently denied Paisley's claims. But when I asked him why he got 50% ownership of Max Inc., why Peggy Begich insisted he be a partner in the business, even though, at the time, Peggy had plenty of money and Zivinich, a bartender, had no experience managing a bar, he didn't have a good answer. In fact, he said he's still not sure. So the story of our Alaska trip is, in part, like that of Arizona, one of frustration, interviews denied, dead-end leads. That's to be expected, to be honest. It's not like I thought we'd fly into Anchorage and solve everything in a matter of days. When I say we, by the way, I'm talking about myself plus three of our producers, Ben Bolin, Paul Deckant, and Chris Brown. Past interviews, past the bombing claim, the most important reason we went to Alaska was to embark on a search for the missing plane, and not some fake search, because I heard interesting stories about certain reality TV shows fabricating searches in Alaska. This search was real. In late 2015, I received an absolutely fascinating tip from a man named Bob Martinson, a longtime commercial fisherman and photojournalist. Around 1980, Bob said, he and two other men, including his dad, were fishing off the coast of an island in Prince William Sound when they pulled up something surprising, part of a Cessna tail. Here's Bob.
I had a reel in the boat that would pull the net in, and I'd step on a cord to operate the hydraulic valve, and it would just bring the net in, and when I came to weeds or sticks or fish or whatever in the net, you just take your foot off the pedal and pick it out of the net. Well, something big and loud and metallic clunked into the bow of the skiff. And I thought, what the heck is that? And to look over and see the tail of an airplane was pretty shocking, to say the least. But, you know, I didn't want to drop it. Because of all the tangled metal, it was fairly fresh-looking tears, you know, but like I said, the aluminum was shiny and it didn't have things growing on it.
Bob found the tail wreckage in Port Etches, off the coast of Hinchinbrook Island, at the entrance of Prince William Sound. It came up in the lead of his purse seine, a type of net.
And it was when I was fishing with my dad and a guy named Ole Risa. And we fished Port Etches quite often. And We didn't usually fish this one beach, but we tried it because we saw some fish over there, and we lay a lead off of the beach, which is a heavy white net that the fish will see, and it takes them out to where the purse seine can operate without hanging up on rocks. And so it leads the fish off of the beach. And when I picked up the lead, it had a tail of what looked like a Cessna. It was pretty shredded, you know, obviously. The rest of the plane was gone. So what I caught in the net was probably all that remained on that beach.
Amazingly, most of the tail number was still visible.
I know it's been a long time, but would you feel comfortable saying that it was at least four characters?
Yeah, it was like four or five numbers. And the tail was, 4.5 feet. The piece I had was like 4.5 feet, 5 feet long, and maybe 3-4 feet tall. It was pretty much the whole upper section of the tail.
And can you tell me more detailed? You mentioned Port Etches. Do you remember exactly, specifically, where around Hinchinbrook you caught it?
Yeah, it was the western shore of Port Etches, just outside of the entrance to Constantine Harbor.
And how far off the shore? How deep into the water?
Oh, it was probably maybe 150 feet offshore, and maybe 20 feet, 30 feet deep, something like that.
Bob remembers the tail as being reddish and white. The color of the missing plane was described on paper as orange and white, but I'm not sure which shade of orange. Bob also told me that he's shade blind, so the reddish color he remembers could have been more of an orange.
You know, I had asked you a few years ago if you had any photos. Do you by chance have a chance to look, or do you know if you have any photos of the tailpiece?
No, I don't think I do. We were fishing. It's possible I could have taken them, but then it would have been on film, and I don't remember seeing pictures of it.
And could you tell me what kind of, you were talking a little bit about the condition, what kind of condition was it in?
Well, the tail looked like a fairly new plane. Like, it didn't have anything growing on it, I don't remember. It looked pretty shiny, but it was shredded, you know, like it was torn off. And it was just the upright section of the tail, you know, the top piece.
Bob said that he, his dad, and their fishing partner, Ole Riza, reported the wreckage, including the partially visible tail number, to the Alaska State Trooper's office in Cordova, a town on Prince William Sound. He doesn't remember exactly how, whether they radioed it in or reported it once they got back. He's also fuzzy on what they did with the actual wreckage. He doesn't recall whether or not they left it in the water, brought it to Cordova themselves, or sent it back on a tender, a small boat that resupplied them during their fishing trip.
I know we reported it, and I know we heard that it was suspicious because of the numbers and the coloring. And so it seems like they wanted that piece, and I can't remember what we did with it. You know, we were in the middle of fishing, so there's not a lot of room on the boat, so I don't know if we kept it. You know, I mean, something like that's pretty important, so I doubt I threw it out until they said it wasn't important or something. And I don't remember if anybody came and collected it or, you know, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, but they specifically told you that it might be tied to the missing Boggs baggage plane?
Yes. Yeah, that's the only reason I was aware of it, you know.
What Bob does clearly remember is that after the troopers got the partial tail number, they were very interested in the wreckage. So let me dig in here and review a few things. First, Bob is reliable. I wouldn't take a lead from some random person this seriously without vetting them. I checked his background. People in Cordova know him. He is a longtime fisherman and photographer. He's calm. He hasn't sought out media attention, ever. He only contacted me in 2015 after reading about my work because I specifically mentioned Hinchinbrook Island, the island off which he found the tailpiece. Sadly, the two men with Bob that day, his dad and Oli Riza, who could have corroborated his story, have died. But in 2019, I spoke with Oli's son, Steve, a physician in Washington State, who said Bob is reliable and honest. Steve used to fish in Alaska with Bob, Bob's dad, and his dad. He stopped right before he went to med school in 1979. Since he wasn't there when the other men pulled up the tailpiece, they must have found it around 1980 or later, he said, which matches up with what Bob told me. I also compared everything Bob said in 2015 with what he told me in 2019. His story was consistent. So I believe Bob. I believe that he found part of a plane. The question is whether or not it was part of the missing plane. Second, the location where Bob found the tailpiece is very interesting. Nearly every person I interviewed believes the missing plane crashed into Prince William Sound, somewhere between Portage Pass and Hinchinbrook Island. See, there was a communication station on Hinchinbrook that the pilot, Don Johns, should have been able to use to make radio contact while over the sound. But the day he vanished, he didn't. Now, there are multiple possible explanations for this. His radio could have failed. He might have been flying low, somewhat off course, and unable to make line-of-sight contact. But the likeliest explanation is that he crashed somewhere between Portage Pass and Hinchinbrook into Prince William Sound. So the spot where Bob found the Cessna tail, right off Hinchinbrook, lines up, roughly, with the missing plane's flight path. Third, while a number of planes have crashed on or near Hinchinbrook, most were recovered, or their crash sites were cataloged. There are only so many Cessna-like planes that disappeared in the vicinity of Hinchinbrook before 1980 and were never found. Unfortunately, I can't give you an exact number. The database of crashes hosted by the NTSB is clunky, incomplete, and hard to parse. If, somehow, we were able to get this figure, to know that, say, 10 Cessna-like planes vanished within 20 miles of Hinchinbrook before 1980, it would help immensely. We would be able to better judge the odds of whether or not the tailpiece Bob found belonged to the Begich Boggs plane. Fourth, the color of what Bob found roughly matches the color of the missing plane. He remembers it as being reddish and white. The missing plane, again, was orange and white. But Bob is shade blind, so there's some ambiguity. One key piece of documentation that would be invaluable right now is a photo of the missing plane, which Don Johns repainted around 1970 when he bought it. But I've never been able to find one, and I asked everyone. So here's the next best thing, a description of the plane and its coloration from the mechanic who worked on it the day before it disappeared. Here's Phil Hewitt.
I can't remember what the name of the color was, but it was a fairly bright. It was I'm going to call it an international orange color and white. And the orange was on the top portion of the aircraft. And it was, I don't remember it being striped. I remember where the orange was. It was a solid color, but the whole airplane wasn't orange. It was orange and white. It was a two-tone. And, you know, it's just multi-engine Cessna 310C.
And with the tail numbers, do you remember where the tail number was painted on the plane?
Yeah, it was... if I remember correctly, it was on the tail, you know, on the upright, the rudder. It wasn't visible from the air, looking down on it.
Would it have been painted at the top or bottom of the tail in small or large characters?
I think it was in the middle of the rudder tail, and it was... The font size was to fit the basically the whole middle of that tail rudder. It wasn't overly big and it wasn't overly small. They had so many numbers and letters to get into that space that that's where it was.
And so when you say the middle, it was kind of like, I know what the plane looks like. So if I'm looking at the tail, it would kind of just be like dead set in the middle and going across the tail.
Horizontally across. It wasn't at a skew or anything like that. It would just horizontal down about midway of that tail rudder.
And was the tail also two-tone? Was it also orange and white?
I don't remember that. If it was, it might have been.
Fifth, and most importantly, Bob said that four or five characters were still visible on the tailpiece. The Begich Boggs tail number had six characters, N1812H. The N doesn't mean much. It's generic and on most small planes in the U.S. But if Bob found a tailpiece that said N181 or N1812, that would be extremely significant. The odds of a Cessna tail with four or five of the same characters as that of the missing plane, with a similar color, found off Hinchinbrook Island, not being the Begich Boggs plane, are next to zero. This is why I think Bob's lead is the most important lead on where the plane may have crashed in nearly 50 years. According to Bob, troopers in Cordova were very excited when they learned about the Cessna tail. They thought it could be part of the Begich Boggs plane. A key question I had for Bob: did the troopers say that before they learned the partial tail number, or after? Because if before, it's not surprising that they would have linked it, possibly, to a famous missing plane. But if after, if they still thought it was part of the missing plane, that's very important, because they almost certainly would have known the tail number of the missing plane, and they would have compared it to what Bob found. Bob said the troopers told him they thought it was part of the Begich Boggs plane after they compared the tail numbers. This is why I was so excited that day, a month earlier, in Arizona, when Bob texted me the exact coordinates of where he found the tail. And this is why, as winter loomed, I boarded a salvage boat and went onto Prince William Sound, to Hinchinbrook Island, to that exact spot. Next time on Missing in Alaska.
We have a radio, we have an air horn, and flares.
So, I'm on channel 10. If you see a bear coming towards us,
yep,
let us know.
Are we all getting in the boat?
Yeah.
Okay.
This week, I have two very important tasks for you. First, look for a photo of the missing plane, an orange and white twin-engine Cessna 310C with the tail number N1812H. Second, help us figure out how many small planes crashed on or in the vicinity of Hinchinbrook Island before 1980, especially if wreckage was never located. We'd love to speak with an expert who can sort through NTSB data and give us an exact number. You can reach us by phone at 1-833-MIA-TIPS. That's 1-833-642-8477. Again, 1-833-642-8477. Or you can reach us via email at tips@iheartmedia.com. That's tips, T-I-P-S, at iheartmedia.com. Ben Bolin is our executive producer. Paul Deccan is our supervising producer. Chris Brown is our assistant producer. Seth Nicholas Johnson is our producer. Sam Teagarden is our research assistant. And I'm your host and executive producer, John Walczak. You can find me on Twitter at John Walczak, JONWALCZAK. Special thanks to Bob Martinson. Missing in Alaska is a co-production of iHeartMedia and Greenfort Media.